Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Iraq, about the American invasion and occupation, and our guest is someone who has been following the politics of Iraq now for more than. His name is Ali Alawi. He has been an advisor to the Prime Minister of Iraq and also has held positions in the Iraqi government after the invasion and occupation. He served as Minister of Trade and Minister of Defense in the cabinet appointed by the interim Iraqi Governing Council from September 2003 until 2004. He also served as Minister of Finance in the Iraqi transitional government between 2005 and 2006. During the time of Saddam Hussein, he was part of the Iraqi exile community living in London. He's been professor at Oxford University. He has degrees in civil and environmental engineering from MIT and MBA from the Harvard Business School. He's authored a book that's been out for some time now, that is titled The Occupation of Iraq, the subtitle Winning the War, Losing the Peace. This book is published by the Yale University Press, in which he takes a look at some very basic questions about why it is the United States decided to invade Iraq, about how the occupation was handled, and why it is that Iraq is in the state that it is today. He's done quite a number of interviews and has talked about it quite a lot, and the book has gotten a lot of attention, as you might expect, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us talking this morning. He is on the campus of Brown University, and so we have a very high-quality connection, and we're pleased to have that. It might sound as if he's here in the studio with us, but he is not. As we talk, questions are welcome, and I certainly would invite people into the conversation, but again, as we usually do, I'd like to ask people to please keep their comments brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep our program moving along. But certainly, listeners are invited to join. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here you'd like to join us, you're certainly welcome to do that. Mr. Alawi, hello.
Hi there. How are
you? Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I think probably you would want it made clear here initially that although, as I say, you have been an advisor to the Iraqi prime minister and have had these posts in the government of Iraq, that you are that the views you express are your own, and that no one certainly should think that you are somehow speaking for the Iraqi government.
Yes, absolutely correct. Whatever I say is my opinion.
And also, I'd like to make it clear here at the beginning, as I have read, and you can tell me, that at least initially, you did not support the invasion of Iraq, and that it sounds as if when it came to the point where it was certain that it was going to happen, that your support was reluctant, or would you even have said at that point you thought that it was not a good idea?
Well, I mean, I went on record actually quite on a number of occasions in 2002, and it became clear that the United States was determined to overthrow the regime of Saddam. And our position, or my position, was that it should help the Iraqi opposition and try to give it the means to confront the regime. But towards the end of 2002, around December, it became clear that the United States has taken basically a decision to invade the country. And at that point, I cautioned against it. And again, we had a number of discussions in the London conference between the Iraqi opposition and the American intermediaries, interlocutors with us, where we made it clear, at least I stood up and said, that there should be no attempt to invade and occupy the country. What you should do is to help the Iraqi opposition to meet the challenges directly. But when the time came and it became clear that the invasion was going on, and no matter what we said, it was not going to influence the policymakers in Washington, we went along. I mean, at least I did. I accepted that this is an inevitable act and that we have to make the best of it.
Hmm. I think that many Americans were very confused initially and may still be confused about why it is that the Bush administration made this decision. And perhaps it was not helped by the fact that at different points, different people speaking for the administration gave different reasons for the invasion. And as conditions changed, we were told different things, ultimately settling on the argument that this regime change was for the benefit of the people of Iraq to remove a repressive government and make it possible for them to have a democratically elected government and to move forward from there. As you understand it, if I asked you the question, why do you think the United States invaded Iraq, is there a clear answer?
Not really. I mean, you can't pinpoint one single causal factor and say that this was it, and to the exclusion of everything else. But if you look at it in retrospect, there was a faction in the United States and throughout the 1990s that was building a case for war against Saddam and war against Iraq throughout the Clinton administration. And this faction, which probably did not think that it was going to come to power, or at least that it was not going to be at the heart of power, in fact, got into a position where they could influence very seriously the decision-making of the U.S. president. But in the first few months of the Bush administration, that's before 9/11, they couldn't make the case for the invasion and occupation of the country. So it stayed basically as an argument without any serious backing to it. But after 9/11, the threat from Iraq was conflated, as it were, with the direct terrorist threat. And they moved into the heart of decision-making. What was really a fringe argument or a fringe position became the position of the U.S. government. And I don't think it could have also taken place without the peculiar perspectives on international policy after 9/11 by the U.S. president, by Mr. Bush. So if you ask me what were the three critical factors, I would say, above all, 9/11, because that created the enabling environment, as it were. Secondly, the existence of an argument or a case for the invasion of the country, sponsored by a large number of intellectuals, academics, and scholars with quite good pedigree in the think tanks in Washington. And thirdly, the acknowledgement and acceptance of this line of argument by the president. Without these three factors, I don't think it would have happened. I don't think any other president possibly would have made that extraordinary decision, because it was an extraordinary decision in international relations terms.
Certainly.
Forgive
me for interrupting. Go ahead.
I mean, the nature of the threat, I think, did not change from Iraq after 9/11. It's just that the way that threat was, if you want to use the word, packaged for the American public, that's what made it palatable to the majority of people here.
You make the argument in the book that for a variety of reasons, in part because of the effects of many years of sanctions, in part because of the repressive regime of Saddam Hussein, his attacks, particularly against the Shiites of the country and of the Kurds, that Iraq on the eve of invasion was a country that was so weakened and so unstable that there was no way things could not have gone. I'm phrasing this poorly. That there was no way things could not have gone badly. That is that one, and I think you also have been critical of the U.S. government in failing to understand Iraq and the political dynamics of Iraq. What one should one have been able to foresee what happened after Saddam was toppled?
Frankly, very few people could anticipate or could forecast that the invasion of the country would lead to this chaos. At least, as far as I know, a lot of people who were against the war were not against it because the possibility that there would be chaotic conditions subsequently. They were against the war for entirely different reasons. But those who were for the war, or those who prepared in the planning for the war, never conceived that the situation would unravel this way. What really happened is that basically the Iraqi state in terms of its administrative functions, its institutions, its people, its personnel was destroyed. It wasn't that the United States just removed a kind of thin layer of ruling Baathists or the ruling clique and then replaced them with a transitional regime that would then lead to elections and democracy. What happened is that the state collapsed, and the Iraqi state, with all of its institutions, lost its ability to govern the country. So the U.S., I don't think, could have predicted that, and very, very few people could have foreseen how weak and unstable and basically brittle the state, not the government, the state. I'm talking about the entire structure of the administrative and institutional machinery of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And that collapsed just after 9/11. Just after April 9th, 2003. So what happened subsequent to that is basically the disintegration of the state and then the attempts by people who had controlled the Iraqi government before, together with foreign elements, to organize a kind of resistance or terrorist campaign to come back into power. That was not at all forecast at that point.
Well, you do say and have said that you feel that the United States failed to understand Iraq before the invasion. Was there a key point or a couple of key points that you think it would have been important for the United States to know that perhaps would have influenced this decision of whether or not to invade at all?
I think so. I mean, you know, there's enough talent in the United States, I mean, in the government, amongst academics, scholars, businessmen. A lot of people know what's going on in the Middle East. It's not that the United States lives on a different planet from the rest of us. But this talent was not used in order to develop a kind of realistic image of what the country was like. The argument to invade Iraq was primarily ideological. And it was covered up by arguments for, in terms of the war on terror, and it was covered up also by arguments regarding just wars and establishing democracy in the Middle East and changing the political culture of the Arabs and of Muslims generally. So once you have ideology driving these decisions, it became very difficult to listen to alternative voices and alternative ways of looking at the problem. The British, who had probably a more realistic, or you can call it even a cynical attitude about the country, were not really given the leeway, neither by the Americans nor by the Prime Minister Blair at that point. He also had made a decision that there was going to be a war, and that they had better be on the right side of the United States. So whatever arguments could have been made that were more cautionary or precautionary or that were more doubting as to the outcome of the war were not given any serious attention. So you had basically a kind of bandwagon effect in both in Washington and to a lesser extent in London that made it difficult to counteract this, this tendency.
We have a caller I'd like to bring into the conversation and also introduce again our guest for anyone who has tuned in the last few minutes. Ali Alawi has been a senior advisor to the Prime Minister of Iraq. Since the coalition's invasion of Iraq, he served as his country's first post-war civilian minister of defense. He was elected to the Transitional National Assembly as a member of the United Iraqi Alliance and was appointed Minister of Finance under Dr. Ibrahim al-Jafri. He is author of the book, The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. It's published by the Yale University Press, and he has been quite critical of the United States, of the decision to invade, and of the way that the occupation was carried out after that. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have some callers here, and our first is in Seneca and on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. Hey, you know what? I love this gentleman, sir. I'm glad that you're speaking out and telling the truth about this. I think most Americans believe that we should have never been over there in the first place, but unfortunately we've got a government that's in some ways far worse than some other countries in the world. They're dictating to us, and they're not getting the job done. I believed in what Bush said in the beginning, and when I found out that there was no real reason why we needed to go in the first place, I started believing those who say this is the reason we went in there is for the sake of oil and the sake of Halliburton and big companies getting jobs. Now, just so you know, most of America, I think, believes that. The sad fact is now we're in there. What do we do? I firmly believe that we need to get out of there, but at the same time, I think you guys need to step it up, too, as far as the government, and try and get your government back on track for what you as Iraqi citizens want, not listening to somebody like me and not listening to our government, but what Iraqis want for Iraqis. That's the problem. I'm one of those who believe we should just leave our noses out, and I think there's a lot more Americans that believe this, but the thing is, a lot of our men and women over there, young kids, died for you guys. And there's going to be a lot of resentment if we do pull out. It kind of our kids' Vietnam is what I relate it to, because of a screw-up on our government's behalf as far as, where the real culprits for the 9/11 situation is. And, you know, I feel sorry for I had to say this. As an American, you know, my hats are off to you guys for taking the beating and still being out there at the same time. I think you also need to step up on your half and inform your government and do something.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll let it go up. God bless you guys. Hopefully everything will work out in the end and everything will get better.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment. Let me ask you to address the direct question, and I'm sure that this is a question you are asked all the time, and that is now, at this point, what would you like to see the United States do?
Well, it's difficult, but I think the United States should disengage from Iraq in a gradual but relatively quick way. So when I say gradual, I don't mean gliding out over the next decade, but say over the next 18 months. And the reason really is from an Iraqi point of view. You have your own variables in this country that would dictate when and how you're going to leave. But in terms of Iraqi politics, the presence of American troops right now is really only you have two main supporters for it. One is the former insurgents who have switched sides and are now working with U.S. forces against the Al-Qaeda. The other group that wants the United States to stay there is what I call the political class in Baghdad. And these people basically rely on the United States to do the heavy lifting while they try to seize control over the new state that's being organized. Until and unless the United States disengages from Iraq, I think our politics will always be what I would call infantile, dependent on the United States, both militarily in terms of security and not allowing the United States to get involved in the direct management of the country and leaving these new crew of politicians to divvy up power between themselves. So to me, the presence of the United States forces, now that the security environment has improved substantially, not necessarily because of the surge, but mainly because of the switch of the insurgents from being an anti-American force to being a force financed by the U.S. government. That phase, what I call the first phase of the Iraq crisis, has ended, and it ended last year, I think, whereby the presence, the very large-scale presence of U.S. forces is no longer absolutely required for maintaining security. So I think you should make it clear that your presence in Iraq will be more political and diplomatic and less military, and that if this government is not going to get its act together and articulate a vision for the country and for all of its component parts, then the United States should not be there indefinitely in order to create the environment for these people to continue in their bickering and in their politicking.
To address the other point that the caller made, and again, I think that it is a question that many Americans have, and that is why the Iraqi government has not been more effective.
Well, because the Iraqi government really did not get into power as a result of its own efforts. I mean, most of the groups that came into power, frankly, could not have reach that point were it not for the American invasion and occupation of the country. The political order that has emerged in the country, with one or two exceptions, is basically came in from exile and were involved in grabbing or accumulating power at the center because the United States was there. So these people were not the end result of a long political process with deep roots in the country. There are some groups, obviously, that have deep roots in the country, but these tend to be not particularly accepted in Washington. So the reason why the Iraqi establishment, as it were, the new political establishment, is so fragile and is insecure is because it doesn't have deep-rootedness in the politics of the country and is now trying to... this is partly due also to the fact that Iraq was living 30, 40 years under dictatorship. It's just not a natural way for groups to achieve power coming in basically on the back of a large occupation army. In time, of course, they may coalesce into a political groups with deep roots, but so far they don't. So far, they are still what I call green zone politicians, people whose power is based on their relationship with the United States rather than on any deep roots inside the country.
We have others to talk with. We'll talk next with someone here in Urbana, where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Uh-huh. A fascinating interview. Could your guest comment on the provisional government imposed by Washington under J. Paul Bremer and on the conduct of these contractors from companies like Aegis and Blackwater, which are... new in the kind of these just in U.S. government operations in foreign countries where we have conflict. So I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
All right.
Well, on the first side, I have to admit I was part of that government. So, but I'm also, critical. I hope to be critically or constructively critical about the comments I make. The way in which this government was cobbled together really is part of the incoherent policies that were used by the United States in the early days of the occupation. I mean, Mr. Bremer came in with the intention of acting as a viceroy without any local support. But in time, very soon after he arrived, he knew that he could not run the country without some kind of Iraqi face. So that's when he tried to then put together a governing group that was, to some extent, based, or to a large extent, based on individuals from the Iraqi opposition. So it was a kind of mutant government. You had three different governments in Iraq. You had the government associated with Mr. Bremer, which is the occupation authority, which ultimately had the final power. You had the governing council, which was a group of senior Iraqi politicians who acted as a kind of overseer over the government. And then you had ministers who were responsible for different departments. So you had three different units trying to run the country, with the military having its own rules of conduct. The civilian administration under Mr. Bremer controlling both the money and controlling, with its authority coming from UN resolutions. You had the governing council, which was a group of senior Iraqi politicians trying to jockey for power. And you had the ministers, some of whom were able, most of whom were not, who were trying to manage a state whose institutions had collapsed. So the whole thing was really, it's like the Keystone Cops. If you were in Baghdad between 2003 and 2004, you'd have seen this contradictory world unfold in front of you. As for these foreign companies or the military contractors that your caller referred to, these, I'm afraid, they're part and parcel of the way that the war is being conducted these days. War is privatized. There's a whole slew of these companies that feed off the Pentagon and that feed off the U.S. military abroad. And once the army moves, U.S. army moves, it drags alongside, like sort of the old Roman army, a huge number of camp followers. But these camp followers are not scavengers, and these camp followers are major corporations. And there's a whole universe of contacts and relationships between these companies and the Pentagon, and there's a whole under shadowy world of contractors and middlemen and fixers. Very, very unpleasant world, I might add. I think somebody or some people in the United States should throw some light on it, because it's not always works to the advantage of the American people. And a lot of them, I'm afraid, are overcharged, they overbill, and they take advantage of opaque practices, especially in times of war.
All right. And let's talk with another caller. This is also someone in Urbana. This is line number two.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, I'm curious about the Shiite-Sunni schism in sort of daily life. There was someone on a while back, it was some guy who said that his to-be father-in-law didn't even ask, whether he was Sunni or Shiite, and I was, like, kind of astounded by this. So is this, quote, mixed marriages very uncommon? Is it an anomaly, or is there truly not that level of animosity at the family level?
Well, the Shia-Sunni split, I mean, is real. It's not something that's invented. But in Iraq, over a long period of time, there was considerable amount of coexistence and intermarriage. When I say considerable amount, I don't mean more than maybe 5% of total marriages were between the sects. Iraq was becoming more and more non-sectarian in a social way, social sense, although power in the country continued to be dominated by the Sunni minority. What happened in the 1990s is that the state, or Saddam, in trying to cement his control over the country, especially after the uprising, the Shia uprising of 1991, began to adopt very serious discriminatory policies that affected the Shia disproportionately more than anybody else. The Kurds, of course, at that point had basically left the country because they were living in a safe zone in the northeast of the country. When the war took place, or when the regime was overthrown on April 9th, there was very, very serious sectarian differences. The uprising of 1991 led to the killings of hundreds of thousands of people, nearly all Shias. And the regime started using very pronounced anti-Shia rhetoric. That doesn't mean that in the upper middle classes or the middle classes of Baghdad there was sectarian consciousness. It was beginning to die out, as it were, especially in the upper income groups. But I'm afraid that the clock was turned back in the 1990s, and by the time the Americans came and we returned to Iraq, the environment had changed completely, and Iraq has become much more of a sectarian country than the one that I knew when I left. But sectarian politics, however, really are a dead end, because what do you do? What are the basis of sectarian politics? Either you dominate the country in the name of your sect, in which case you become oppressive, or you decide that your sect constitutes a different nation or group, in which case you decide you want to divide the country up. So I'm afraid that if we don't find a solution that goes beyond sectarian politics, the future is not really very bright for either democracy or human rights in the country, or even for its political survival.
When people say that perhaps the future of the country lies in a federation of semi-autonomous states, one being a Kurdish state, the other being a Shia state, that would be the majority of the Iraqi Arabs, and then the third would be Sunni. How do you react to people who say that in fact it's not really possible for Iraq to be one country, but that it would end up having to be an arrangement of these semi-autonomous, ethnically based states?
Well, that's really the problem that has been hounding Iraq since its foundation, that we have not been able to find a common basis for nationhood. The number of elements have been tried. We tried to impose on Iraq an Arab identity. That didn't work because you have Kurds in the country. You try to construct an identity around sects, that doesn't work, because a sect is not a national consciousness. You try to create an identity around religion, but that doesn't work because 95% of Iraqis are Muslims. You can't create an identity around geography, say, the way that Switzerland, mountains and so on, because the country was put together. So we have been unable right now, up to this point, to create a kind of national consciousness where the entire citizenry would subscribe. The U.S., as I must say, as after the occupation, tried to push the idea that Iraq should be built around institutions and around principles and ideas such as democracy, human rights, freedoms, and so on. That, I'm afraid, didn't work because we don't have the relationship that you have, say, with your constitution or with your founding fathers. There isn't a common political experience. So we're still groping to find a common sense of identity and a common sense of nationality that would unite us. Now, in time, it might happen. But whether these pressures to think in terms of ethnic or sectarian terms become greater than that, than the race to find a new national basis, new national compact. Mm. I thought when I was there that the process of writing the new constitution would help to sort out these problems and, you know, bring them out to the open and have sort of the Iraqi version of the Federalist Papers. But it didn't work out. It was just a document that was slapped together in a few weeks.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get right to, but for the benefit, again, of people who might have tuned in, I'd like to introduce, once again, our guest, Ali Alawi. He has served as Minister of Trade and Minister of Defense in Iraq in the cabinet appointed by the interim Iraq Governing Council from September 2003 until 2004. He also served as Minister of Finance in the Iraqi transitional government between 2005 and 2006. He was part of the Iraqi exile community in London during the time that Saddam Hussein was in power. He's been a professor at Oxford University, holds degrees in civil and environmental engineering from MIT and also MBA from Harvard Business School. He's the author of a recently published book. It has been out for a while now. The title of the book is The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. It's published by the Yale University Press, and his assessment of conditions in Iraq before and after the invasion, why it is the United States decided to invade, and why it is that things have gone as they have. Questions are, again, welcome. We'll try to get in as many as we have in the time that remains. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Mattoon and on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if you might comment on the view that Saddam was a serious threat to Israel and that Israel had at one time bombed what might have been a nuclear or the beginning of a nuclear plant, and more of it, he was more of a threat than some of the other countries in the area, and that I believe that Saddam did send rockets into Israel, didn't he, during the first Gulf War? Just wonder if you might comment on that view.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Alawi.
I think by the time the 1990s rolled by, Saddam was a threat to no one. I mean, it became clear that the weapons of mass destruction, by that the nuclear arsenal, was dismantled effectively by the UN. The army was completely degraded. Iraq as a kind of frontline state against Israel was always a bit of a misnomer. I mean, the country participated in a very, very superficial way in the various Arab-Israeli wars. It sent a brigade in 1973, and by the time the Iraqi brigades marched in 1967, the war was over. But if you tell me whether in Israel's national security planning, do they account for a threat that might come from a strong Iraqi state were it to be organized and unified and so on? Probably yes. I mean, but it wasn't certainly the threat that came from Saddam. Saddam, when he built his nuclear weapons, I think would have used them probably against Iran before he would use them against Israel. in the 1991 Gulf War, he did fire Scud missiles into Israel. But that really wasn't for any military, had no military significance. It was mainly to rally Arab public opinion on his side in the upcoming confrontation with the U.S. So I don't think Iraq was ever a serious threat or could be a serious threat. And the 1990s was hardly a threat to anyone except to its own people. So I don't really accept that argument. Mm. Although the, as I said, the dismantling of the Iraqi state may serve the purposes of certain people who think in, along these lines in terms of national security of Israel. But I don't think this is a commonly held view inside Israel.
All right. Let us continue. We'll talk next with someone in Effingham. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Could you comment about the history of the last 900 years with Westerners and Easterners? The thing that comes to my mind, that an old saw about East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. Well, I mean, they have and will continue to do that. But the influence that the West, and particularly England, in the Middle East and the French in Africa and Asia, and the colonialist paradigms that were set, you know, even in Greek and Trojan times, and that's been a very long time ago. And here we are in the 21st century still acting out those power struggles and the innocence of the populations that are involved who have to bear the brunt of those machinations by foreign governments and then the stooges within their own governments, such as Saddam, I think, who was probably, being a Sunni, and he had socialist ideas and cuddled up to Russia now and then, and was much hated by most of the West. Could you comment on those things and how that's still in sway to this day?
Mm-hmm. I think the caller was made really a very important point. I mean, I can't really paraphrase 900 years in a few minutes, but I can say that the idea that there's a clash of civilizations hasn't gone away. Who holds to that idea is the main issue. And whether the Islamic world, of which Iraq is a part, is inevitably going to face a series of crises with the Western world I think, an issue. I'll say, just as it relates to me personally, when I went back to Iraq in 2003, I went back thinking that maybe 70-80% of our problems are caused by us, our inability to organize ourselves, our inability to come up with a political culture that encourages and strengthens freedoms and liberties and democracy and so on. And 30% was due to the foreign meddling in our affairs. When I left, I haven't left, but when I left government in 2006, I've reversed this thinking. I think that a serious part of the problems of the Middle East especially is due to incessant meddling in its affairs by foreign powers. Now we talk about oil. The U.S. has an entire carrier group sitting in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf. Probably the military presence of the United States in the Middle East, outside of the Iraq war, probably costs you maybe upwards of $1.5 trillion, maybe $2 trillion. It's a kind of mindset that sees this part of the world as being either the source of problems or the source of vital requirements for Western civilization, which have to be dominated militarily. That kind of thinking, I think, rather than a constructive attempt to engage with that part of the world, the way that you engage, for example, with East Asia, that was extremely constructive and to the benefit of first Japan and then Korea and now China. But the Middle East doesn't seem to fall into that, or the Islamic world generally does not seem to fall into that pattern. So there is an element of truth, I think, but self-fulfilling truth to the clash of civilizations when it comes to the way that the major powers of the times deal with the that part of the world, with the Middle East especially. And our experience has been, in the last 200 years, has been very, very poor. Before, as I said, I used to think it was our problem. But now I think it is to do with this incessant meddling that is built on fear and anxiety that some foreign powers would seize control over the lifeline of Western civilization, in this case oil and energy, and cut you off. So fear is still there, I'm afraid. Mm. And there's counter, you know, on our side, on not on our side, but on the side of the Muslims and the extremists amongst them. There's a counter-argument which breeds resentment and finally terror.
One more caller here, at least in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to hark back to that first call, the call for the Iraqi government to, quote, step up. This seems a very popular position in the U.S. press. I would like to point to one of the factors that is causing paralysis in the Iraqi government. The U.S. administration attempt to force legislation through which would turn over large portions of the Iraqi economy to American U.S. Businesses. I would point first to the oil legislation, which there's been so much comment on from our own administration that they must get this through. It would, I believe, turn over the entire Iraqi oil industry to American corporations, with very little of the profit going to the Iraqi people, something very similar to what happened in Iran in 53. There's other legislation which was first introduced with Bremer that would allow a fire sale purchase of Iraqi industry by primarily U.S. industries and would allow them to take all profits out of Iraq. It seems to me as long as the U.S. administration attempts to pressure this type of thing through the Iraqi legislature, there's practically no hope that it can do anything else. Would you comment?
Well, I mean, the oil issue is real. It goes back to my earlier comment, is that now that basically the argument that Iraq can be turned into a liberal democratic society has been shelved, the U.S. interest after security is to do with oil. And the way that the U.S. looks at oil is that here we have very large, probably the largest unexploited oil fields in the world. And they should be brought up to production as soon as possible because they are essential for U.S. energy security. The kind of policies that they were pushing before were actually abandoned very soon thereafter because there wasn't either the popular will inside Iraq to accept them or the will in the United States government to force it down Iraqis' throats. What's happening now is that the U.S., I think, has a policy of bringing these oil fields as quickly into production as possible to increase the level of supplies to the Western world generally and to the U.S. in particular. And, of course, they want to do that in an environment where the companies or the people who are doing it are part of the overall sort of multinational oil industry. I don't think it goes really beyond that. The U.S. doesn't want American companies like Chevron or Exxon to buy the oil or seize the oil or become owners of it. They have accepted or they've reconciled themselves to the fact that Iraq will never pass an oil law that would allow foreign companies direct concessions and ownership. But what they want to do, and that's what the main purpose of the pressures that have been applied on the government, is to get these fields going as soon as possible. And they know that the Iraqi government by itself may not be in a position to generate either the resources or the technical skills that can manage these new oil fields. So there is an element of truth not accusation, but in the statement that the U.S. is interested only in oil. Now it's true. Now I think after security, establishing security and stabilizing the country, getting the oil out is really critical.
In the time remaining, and unfortunately we only have a couple of minutes, but I'd like to have you talk about regional politics in this sense. The administration clearly believed that if a democratic state could be set up in Iraq, that it would be, in a sense, infectious, that kind of spirit of democracy would spread throughout the Middle East. And I don't think anybody now believes that that's what's going to happen. What do you think have been the consequences or will be the consequences of the American invasion and occupation on not just on Iraq, but on its neighbors?
Well, I mean, in the early days, they were very, very fearful what the U.S. plan was going to do, was going to achieve in Iraq, because if the sort of the extreme versions of it prevail, then it would imply that all the other countries, I mean, Syria and Saudi Arabia and so on, would be next in line in terms of sort of a democratic, radical democratic makeover. But following the crisis of the last 5 years and the instability and killings and the destruction, as I said, of the Iraqi state, Iraq is not really an example for any country, and the U.S. has recognized that. The U.S. has recognized that this kind of line, which they basically dropped after a few months, I would say, is not going to be conducive to their overall strategic interests in the area, which are based on a group of countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, some of the Gulf countries, none of which is democratic by any stretch of the imagination, but those who by and large accept the American lead in both energy policy as well as in international relations. So these group of countries have in fact become strengthened in the last few months, contrary to what was originally expected. So, and also as the U.S. is trying to grope for ways of stabilizing the situation, and it has found that it can influence these mainly Sunni Arab countries to take positions that would allow it to secure the situation in Iraq. So I think it's a reaffirmation of the U.S. Commitment, if you want to call it that, to this set of countries who now no longer feel threatened by changes in Iraq anymore. The question now is whether the U.S. is shifting its attentions to Iran rather than Iraq once the situation stabilizes. And there I think the Arab countries are more cautious because they really are not interested in confronting Iran on behalf of the United States directly. Mm. So it still is a very complex thicket, I'm afraid.
Well, we will have to stop there. We've come to the end of the time. If people who are listening to us would want to read more, and I think it's a book that can indeed add to your understanding of Iraq and of the occupation, I would suggest you read the book, The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Ali Alawi. He has been a senior advisor to the Prime Minister of Iraq, also held a number of posts in the country after the occupation, including Minister of Defense and also Minister of Finance. He was speaking to us this morning from the campus of Brown University. We also want to thank the engineer there, John Bottacorsi at Brown. And to you, Mr. Alawi, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.